The second frequently asked question. I just need to hire someone for technical expertise. Why do I need to bother with the four E's? Obviously, hiring a person who is both a technical star and demonstrates the four E's would be very nice. But if you're really just desperate for a person with a certain specialty, say a computer programmer or a research scientist, then I'd be satisfied with energy and passion, along with a bucketful of raw intelligence, great prior experience, and, of course, integrity. You need that with any person you hire. The third question, what if someone's missing one or two of the E's? Can training fill in the gaps? Any candidate you hire in a managerial role must have the first two E's, positive energy and the ability to energize. Those are personality traits, and I don't think they can be trained into somebody. And frankly, I would encourage you not to hire any team member, manager or not, without a good dose of positive energy. People without it just enervate an organization. Edge and execution, on the other hand, can be developed with experience and management training. Time after time, I've seen people learn how to make tough calls and deliver results. The GE audit staff offers numerous examples. Every year, it brings on board about 120 people, primarily from GE's financial management training program, but about a quarter from other functions, such as engineering and manufacturing. The typical new hire in auditing has about 3 years of experience with the company. The first year, these new kids travel to GE businesses around the world as members of 3 to 6 person audit teams. After 12 weeks of grueling analysis, they return to the headquarters of the business they've just audited to present their findings to the CFO and CEO. Often, they've got plenty to tell, some of it not so pretty. Early on, these young auditors are tentative, holding their comments while the more senior members of the team run the show. But over time, usually 3 to 5 years, I've seen these auditors develop an edge that is razor sharp. It comes from observing their more experienced teammates, lots of coaching, and plenty of practice. They also develop an incredible knack for execution. After all, they're responsible for making sure their recommendations have been implemented. If they haven't, all hell breaks loose, and that's a very good teacher. The proof that edge and execution can be learned is clear. Several CEOs of GE's biggest businesses and a vice chairman are veterans of the audit staff development process. The fourth question, can a person get ahead in business without the four E's or passion? The answer is absolutely yes. A person can reach great heights just by being very smart or just by the sheer ability to get things done. We can all think of examples of these individuals. Many are the inventors and entrepreneurs of the world, and usually they run their own shows. But within an organization, I just haven't seen too many have sustained success, especially as leaders, without the four E's and passion. The fifth question often asked, I've always tried to hire people who can hit the ground running. What do you think about that as a decisive factor? When hiring, you have to make a trade-off. Do you hire someone to get a job done fast, or do you hire him based on his potential for growth? My advice is try to pick the second option. I didn't always feel that way. The first time I hired managers was when I was 28 years old and I needed to build a functional team. I hired a PhD who was a peer of mine to be manager of R&D. For marketing, I hired a good fellow who was smart and was there. And for manufacturing manager, my selection was an experienced hand. I'd seen him in action in another part of the same division. Although I didn't think of it at the time, most of these people had no future beyond the jobs I had just put them in. Our business was growing rapidly, and they didn't have the skills to grow with it. In fact, by the time the business was 4 years old, all of them were gone, and we were filling the positions again. With my first shot at hiring managers, I didn't know any better. I just wanted to get the job done. But I eventually learned that it pays to go for the high potentials, who can grow with a business or are capable of moving up elsewhere in the organization. Hiring a highly skilled blocker, someone who will hit the ground running but has no future beyond the open position, is tempting because it solves an immediate need. But blockers soon become enervating. They get bored by the familiarity of the work, or, as in my early case, swamped by its challenges. Their people get discouraged because they see their bosses going nowhere, which makes them wonder about their own opportunities. A good rule of thumb, then, is not to hire someone into the last job of his career, unless it's to be head of a function or CEO. The sixth and final question I often get is, how long does it take to know if you've hired right? The answer, usually within a year, and certainly within two, it is pretty clear if someone is getting the results you'd hope for. It's relatively easy to notice when a person lacks the energy and execution you anticipated. But the ability to energize and the capacity for edge sometimes takes longer to show up in a new environment. People want to fit in before they start rousing the team to a cause or making the tough calls. But as I said, within 2 years at the most, if an employee is still falling short of your expectation, it's time to admit your mistake and start the process of moving the person out. If you've been doing your job and giving honest evaluations along the way, the employee shouldn't be surprised, and an equitable severance package will likewise soften the blow. Hiring right is hard. I'd say as a young manager, I picked the right people about half the time. 30 years later, I had improved to about 80%. My point is, don't beat yourself up if you get hiring wrong some of the time, especially when you're starting out. Situations change, people change, and you change. But just remember, every hiring mistake is yours. You have to fix it, not an HR person you call in to do your dirty work. Take responsibility and make sure the ending is candid and fair. And now for our San Diego question. What is the one thing you should ask in an interview to help you decide whom to hire? If I had just one area to probe in an interview, it would be about why the candidate left his previous job and the one before that. Was it the environment? Was it the boss? Was it the team? What exactly made you leave? There is so much information in those answers. Keep digging and dig deep. Maybe the candidate just expects too much from a job or a company. He wants a boss who is entirely hands-off or teammates who always agree. Maybe he wants too much reward, too fast. Or maybe she's leaving her last job because she has just what you want. Too much energy to be held back. So much ability to energize, she wants to manage more people. Too much edge for a namby-pamby employer. And such a strong ability to execute, she needs more challenge. The key is listen closely. Get in the candidate's skin. Why a person has left a job or jobs tells you more about them than almost any other piece of data. Your goal in hiring is to get the right players on the field. Luckily, great people are everywhere. You just have to know how to pick them. It's so easy to just hire people you like. After all, you'll be spending the majority of your waking hours with them. It's also easy to hire people with relevant experience. They'll get the job done. But friendship and experience are never enough. Every person you hire has to have integrity, intelligence, and maturity. Once you've got those, look hard for people with the four E's and a passion. Beyond that, at the senior level, look for authenticity, foresight, the willingness to draw on others for advice, and resilience. put it all together, and those are the people who win. The third chapter in your company is all about people management. You've got the right players on the field. That's a great start. Now they need to work together to steadily improve their performance, be motivated, stay with the company, and grow as leaders. In other words, they need to be managed. There are libraries of books on people management, not to mention plenty of courses in business schools. There are training programs, magazines and websites, many offering sound advice. And then there is experience. That's mainly what this chapter draws on. During my years at GE, once I was out of the laboratory of plastics, managing people was really what I did. After all, I didn't have the expertise to design jet engines, build CT scanners, or create a comedy program for NBC. Obviously, as CEO, I got involved in everything. Strategy, new products, sales, M&A, and the like. But in that job, I always believed the people part was how I could help GE the most. People management covers a wide range of activities, but it really comes down to six fundamental practices. No person can undertake these activities alone. Far from it. So let me praise them as company-wide practices. To manage people well, companies should 1. Elevate HR to a position of power and primacy in the organization and make sure human resource people have the special qualities to help managers build leaders and careers. In fact, the best HR types are pastors and parents in the same package. 2. Use a rigorous, non-bureaucratic evaluation system, monitored for integrity with the same intensity as Sarbanes-Oxley Act compliance. 3. Create effective mechanisms. Read money, recognition, and training to motivate and retain. 4. Face straight into charged relationships with unions, stars, sliders, and disruptors. 5. Fight gravity, and instead of taking the middle 70% for granted, treat them like the heart and soul of the organization. 6. Design the organization chart to be as flat as possible, with blindingly clear reporting relationships and responsibilities. After being on the road for several years, I realized that some people may read these practices and wonder how, if they adopt them, they'll ever get any real work done. I always thought they were real work. But many Q&A sessions have left me with the impression that at lots of companies, people management is what's done when there's time left over. In the hope that might change, here are the practices in more detail. Practice 1, elevating HR to a position of power in the organization. About 3 years ago, I was in Mexico City, speaking at a convention of 5,000 human resource executives. As usual, the event was set up as a Q&A session with two seats on the stage. In this case, the interviewer was Daniel Svici, the thoughtful, engaging CEO of Grupo Bimbo, one of the country's largest food companies. Daniel and I spent the first 45 minutes talking about strategy, about budgets, global competition, and other business topics before the microphone went into the audience for their questions. The first person to speak identified herself as the head of personnel for a Brazilian manufacturer and, with an urgent voice, asked me about the role of HR in a company. What did I think it should be? My answer was immediate, and to be honest with you, even though I had been making this point publicly for years, I thought it would get a round of applause, given the makeup of the audience. Without doubt, the head of HR should be the second most important person in any organization, I said. From the point of view of the CEO, the director of HR should be at least equal to the CFO. There was a strange hush in the place. In fact, it was so quiet, I thought my Boston accent had thrown off the translator. Isn't that what happens in your companies, I asked? I mean, let's get a show of hands. How many of you work at companies where the CEO treats the director of HR and the CFO with equal respect? 50 hands went up. 50 out of 5,000 people. No wonder no one had clapped. I had accidentally stepped on the toes of about 99% of the crowd. Later, at a reception after the session, one person after another from the audience told me how HR was belittled and underutilized in their organizations. In all, about 30 people told me stories in the same vein. Worse, their reports turned out not to be an exception. I have asked my stature of HR question at about 75 other speaking events since Mexico City. The results are always disturbingly similar. It blows my mind. Even if your company is too small to have its own HR department, somebody's got to be doing HR. And HR just has to be as important as any other function in a company. In fact, why wouldn't HR be as important as finance? After all, if you manage a baseball team, would you listen more closely to the team accountant or the director of player personnel? The input of the team accountant matters. He sure knows how much they can pay a player. But his input certainly doesn't count more than the input from the director of player personnel, who knows just how good each player is. Both belong alongside the CEO, at the table where decisions are made. Unfortunately, at a lot of companies, HR isn't even in the same room. The reasons, I think, are threefold. First, the impact of HR is hard to quantify. You can see how sales and R&D affect performance and how finance tallies it up. But HR deals with air. People skills. Not only are people skills squishy soft, most people assume they have them in spades. How many times have you heard someone say, "I'm a people person"? Second, HR too often gets relegated or pushed into a benefits trap, administering insurance plans and overseeing scheduling issues like vacation and flex time. It also gets saddled with health and happiness activities, putting out the planned newspaper, and organizing the summer picnic. Someone has to take care of these tasks, but if HR gets stuck doing them all the time, its stature will never be what it should. Third, HR becomes twisted up in palace intrigue. Back in the 60s and early 70s, GE went through a period like that. Its HR system ran on gossip, whispers, and tattling. A small and frankly terrifying group of HR executives held secretive opinions about every manager, and they could tie you for life if they wanted. On the other hand, they could also move you up very quickly. They thought of themselves as kingmakers. The game changed completely when Reg Jones, the CEO at the time, appointed Ted Levino to run HR. Ted threw open the shutters and let the light shine in. HR processes soon became transparent, and more importantly, they began to make sense. By the time Ted retired in 1985, HR was on its way to doing exactly what it should be: listening to people vent, brokering internal differences, and helping managers develop leaders and build careers. That's why the best HR people are a kind of hybrid. One part pastor who hears all sins and complaints without recrimination, and one part parent who loves and nurtures but gives it to you fast and straight when you're off track. I've found over the years that the best pastor-parent types have usually run something once in their careers, a factory, a product line, or another function. But I've also seen some come right up through HR. Either way, the best have stature beyond their rank and title. They know the business, its every detail. They understand the tensions between marketing and manufacturing, are between two executives who once went after the same job. They see the hidden hierarchies in people's minds, the invisible org chart of political connections that exists in every company. They know the players and the history. Along with stature, pastor parent types have got integrity oozing out of them. That integrity comes from unrelenting candor and trustworthiness. Pastor parents listen with uncommon care, tell the truth, and hold confidences tight. They also know how to settle a disagreement. We'd all like to believe that good companies don't need referees, but they do. People get passed over for promotions. Interdivisional sales cause all kinds of who-gets-the-credit issues. Bonus pools are perceived to be unfairly distributed. I was lucky enough to have a few pastor-parent types on my team at various points in my career, the last one being Bill Connedy, who I've mentioned before in this book. Bill started out in GE's manufacturing training program and eventually became the manager of the locomotive diesel engine plant in Grove City, Pennsylvania. He then jumped ship to the HR business. He was a natural. No matter whom he was dealing with, a senior executive or an hourly worker, he was as straight as could be with good news and bad. He was a great listener and so discreet that you couldn't squeeze a secret out of him with a vise. I came to appreciate Bill when he was head of HR for Aircraft Engines. The business had a huge crisis in 89 when it was discovered that one of its employees had bribed an Israeli Air Force general to get a jet engine contract. What impressed me was how Bill dealt with the people involved in the mess, some of whom were his peers and friends. He had to make incredibly painful recommendations about letting people go, and he did it with the kind of candor, compassion, and diplomacy that is the ultimate hallmark of a pastor parent. If your HR is on track, pastor parents are ready to handle frictions and crises, channeling anger, forging compromises, and if need be, negotiating dignified endings. They are there to help managers manage people well. Practice number two, use a rigorous non-bureaucratic evaluation system, monitoring for integrity with the same intensity as Sarbanes-Oxley Act compliance. Remember what happened when corporate scandals rocked the American economy? The government reacted quickly by passing the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, which mandates a fine or jail time, or both, for any CEO or CFO who wittingly signs off on bad numbers. The Sarbanes-Oxley Act was necessary to get credibility in financial reporting and restore investor confidence. I just wish that evaluation systems got the same kind of attention and rigor. After all, financial violations happen because of people. Yet people evaluation systems are too often just exercises in paper pushing. Earlier in this book, in the chapter on candor, I mentioned that I often ask audiences, how many of you have received an honest, straight between the eyes feedback session in the past year where you came out knowing exactly what you have to do to improve and where you stand in the organization? To repeat, 20% of the audience raises its hand on a good day, but an average yes response is about 10%. If this unscientific research is anywhere near right, very few companies have meaningful evaluation systems in place. That's not just bad, it's terrible. You simply cannot manage people to better performance if you do not give candid, consistent feedback through a system that is loaded with integrity. There is no one right way to evaluate people. Every company will devise different forms and different methodologies. But any good evaluation system should share some characteristics. It should be clear and simple. washed clean of time-consuming, bureaucratic gobbledygook. If your evaluation system involves more than 2 pages of paperwork per person, something is wrong. I evaluated my 20 or so direct reports with frequent handwritten notes that included 2 pieces of information, what I thought the person did well and how I thought they could improve. A good system should measure people on relevant, agreed-upon criteria that relate directly to an individual's performance. The criteria should be quantitative, based on how people deliver on certain goals, and qualitative, based on how they deliver on desired behaviors. A good system should also ensure that managers evaluate their people at least once a year, and preferably twice, in formal face-to-face sessions. Informal appraisals should happen all the time. But when it comes to formal reviews, one of the face-to-face sessions should let people know where they stand in relation to others. If your company practices differentiation, a good evaluation system is where the rubber meets the road. Finally, a good evaluation system should include a professional development component. Managers should not only talk to their employees about next career steps, but should elicit from them the names of the 2 or 3 people who they think could replace them should they be promoted. Even with all these characteristics, no evaluation system is first rate unless it is constantly monitored for integrity. Someone has to have the responsibility and the accountability to ask if the evaluation system is capturing the truth, just as a good audit team does with the numbers. Does the evaluation system really measure company values? Or does it just measure financial results? Does it get implemented with sincerity? Or do people blow it off as a waste of time? Do people really learn at the end of the evaluation what they must do to improve their performance? Only integrity can keep evaluation systems from becoming paper pushing. And since there is no law to make it happen, and no audit team either, it's up to every boss giving an evaluation with the vigorous support of HR to take this responsibility upon himself or herself. You won't get thrown in jail if you don't, but do it anyway, because it'll make you and your team better. Practice 3, create effective mechanisms. Read money, recognition, and training to motivate and retain. I'll never forget the time I was at a meeting about how GE should reward the winner of the Steinmetz Award, given annually to the company's best scientists. I was a group VP at the time, and so my ears really perked up when one of the vice chairmen, a guy with a lot of stature and a lot of dough, registered his opinion. "These people don't want money," he said. "They want recognition." He must have forgotten where he came from. Of course people want to be recognized for great performance. Plaques and public fanfare have their place. But without money, they lose a lot of their impact. Even the Nobel and Pulitzer Prizes come with cash awards. If your company is managing people well, it tightly aligns good performance with rewards. The better you do, the more you get, and you get it in both the soul and the wallet. There is hardly anything more frustrating than working hard, meeting or exceeding expectations, and discovering that it doesn't matter to your company. You get nothing special, or you get what everyone else does. People need to get differentiated rewards and recognition to be motivated, and companies need to deliver both for retention. It's that simple. Take the case of a woman I know who graduated with a degree in theater design from an Ivy League college and eagerly went to work as a buyer at a prestigious New York City retailer. Despite the grueling hours and low pay, this woman showed immediate promise. Her selections for the sportswear department broke sales records for 6 straight quarters, and she managed to repair the store's relationships with 2 disgruntled vendors. Although it was not part of the job, and other buyers teased her for doing it, she worked the floor and the cash register to better understand her department's customers. For 2 years, this buyer got very little public recognition for her success. That was bad enough, but her bonus was also standard, exactly what the company described as average during the interview process. She had to quit to find out how much she was valued. When she handed in her resignation, her boss was shocked. "But why are you leaving?" she asked. "You have a great future here." "It's so draining. No one ever tells me I'm doing a good job." "Well, no one ever tells me I'm doing a good job," her boss shot back. "That's just the way it goes here. You've got to get a thick skin." Now, retail is a notoriously tough working environment, but the practice of not rewarding performance is commonplace in plenty of industries, and one of the main reasons good people leave. A winning company just does not let good people walk out the door for lack of recognition, financial or otherwise. Another key way to motivate and retain is through training. If you've hired the right people, they will want to grow. They'll be bursting with the desire to learn and do more. A good machinist will want to know how to operate more machines and eventually how to run the shop. A good manufacturing engineer will want to travel to Japan to visit companies using advanced techniques that he has only read about. A good PR person will want to learn how to communicate more effectively on the web. Good people never think they have reached the top of their game, but they're dying to get there. A company that manages people well helps make that happen. If it can afford it, it has in-house training led by its own executives, who serve not only as teachers, but as role models. A company with fewer resources can facilitate training outside at any number of good programs. In either case, the company makes sure that training is seen as a reward for performance, not a sop for time served. Companies cannot promise their people lifetime employment. Global competition is too fierce and economic cycles too frequent for any such guarantees. But they can promise to give their people every chance for employability, skills that will make them more attractive if they are forced to part ways. Like rewards and recognition, training does that. It motivates people by showing them a way to grow, that the company cares, and that they have a future. If you are doing it right, they will want to make that future with you. Practice 4. Face straight into charge relationships with unions, your stars, sliders, and your disruptors. Like families, companies have relationships filled with history or fraught with tension. But managing people well means paying a special attention to these hard relationships, not just letting them fester or float into neglect, approaches that are entirely human but often end in a mess. Good people management requires companies to confront their charge relationships with candor and action. Let's start with unions. When I was at GE, it was well known that I was not a fan of unions. I thought they created conditions that made the company less competitive, and they drove an unnecessary wedge between management and employees. I use the word unnecessary because in my experience, unions arise only when a plant or an office is being managed by someone who is abusive, remote, or indifferent, and whose actions have taken away the voice and dignity of employees. Without a doubt, that boss needs to be reformed or removed because unionization is an excessive response with negative long-term consequences, really for everyone. We did have several long-time unions at GE during my time as CEO. I always felt our relationship was candid and respectful, and we never had a national strike. I can think of 2 reasons why. First, We always stated our principles and stuck to them. And second, we never started our relationship at the negotiating table. Principles first. The most important thing to remember about unions is that they are made up of your own people. You work together, reside in the same towns, and oftentimes your kids go to school or play together. Your lives and futures are intertwined. That is why all you have with unions is your integrity, your word. You can fight about issues, and you will. But your fighting will be more productive if you're always clear about what issues are negotiable and which are untouchable. During negotiations, waffle only on those matters you identified as negotiable and nothing else. Otherwise, your word will be meaningless and your relationship will be without trust. Now to the negotiating table. Make every effort not to have your first date there. A war zone is no place to get acquainted. Almost every time I traveled to the businesses with Bill Connolly, we met with local union representatives. These sessions were mainly to get to know one another better and lay out positions without any immediate agenda. Everyone would get a chance to talk, and even better, in these settings, we were all more inclined to listen. Bill and I always learned a lot, and it served Bill and the company well in every national negotiation. Let's look at another charge relationship to manage, with stars. One thing is certain, you need stars to win. And I have always advocated identifying your stars, that top 20%, and stroking and rewarding them in an outsized way. But stroking can backfire. A star's ego can be a dangerous thing. I've seen talented young people promoted too quickly and their ambitions spin out of control. I've seen terrific financial analysts, engineers, and network executives get told once too many times that they are irreplaceable, and they start swaggering around to the point that their teams resent them. I've seen smart, capable individuals come to believe they are so indispensable they should not be bound by anything, including the company's values. Stars can become monsters if you let them. That's why someone has to be on the lookout, namely the star's boss, with support from HR if you have it. This job cannot fall through the cracks. The minute a star seems to be getting arrogant or out of control, someone has to call the person in to have a candid conversation about values and behaviors. You can never be afraid of your stars. They can't hold a company hostage. Now, sometimes stars surprise you and up and leave. That can be a defining moment. Ideally, the star will be replaced within 8 hours. That's right, 8 hours. This immediate reaction sends the message to the organization that no one is indispensable. It shouts out that no one single individual is bigger than the company. One morning in the summer of 2001, just as Jeff Immelt was about to take over as CEO, Larry Johnson, who was CEO of our appliances business, came to headquarters to tell us he was taking the job as CEO of Albertsons, the large West Coast food and drug chain. Larry was a big presence in GE, with a strong track record and a great reputation. Even though the announcement of his departure knocked the wind out of us, we moved quickly. By 4 o'clock that afternoon, we appointed Jim Campbell, the sales manager in appliances, to Larry's job. Albertsons got a great CEO, and we never missed a beat. Jim was off and running from day one. The only way to be able to replace a star swiftly is to have a slate of people ready to do so. That's where good evaluation systems come in particular, career development planning. That process can surface one or two in-house candidates to replace any star who departs. Just don't wait until the star leaves to start the replacement process. By then, it's too late to make the point. A third complicated relationship is with what I call sliders. These are employees who were once good performers but have hit a wall for some reason or another, ranging from a midlife crisis to a job-related disappointment. A slider, while generally well-liked, now just shows up at work and goes through the motions. In most cases, no one knows what to do about it. In fact, the situation is usually so awkward, people look away. You can't. Sliders need to be re-energized, either with new jobs or training. Otherwise, they fossilize in their jobs and often grow bitter, slowly but surely infecting their groups with disaffection. Often, managers take a long time to let these individuals go because their previous accomplishments were more than acceptable. But a company that manages people well quickly moves to get its sliders back in the game, and if that doesn't work, tells them the game is over. The final relationship that cannot be ignored is with disruptors. These are the individuals who cause trouble for sport, inciting opposition to management for a variety of reasons, most of them petty. Usually these people have good performance. That's their cover, and so they are endured or appeased. A company that manages people well takes disruptors head on. First, they give them very tough evaluations, naming their bad behavior and demanding it change. Usually, it won't. Disruptors are a personality type. If that's the case, get them out of the way of people trying to do their jobs. They're poison. Practice 5. Fight gravity. And instead of taking the middle 70% for granted, treat them like the heart and soul of the organization. As practice 4 would suggest, managers end up spending the vast majority of their people management energy on charged relationships, too often trying to salvage sliders or disruptives. That's natural, but it's a mistake. Most work in an organization gets done by the people in the middle 70, those solid performers who don't quite shine but work hard and well, and perhaps could shine with enough care and attention. You just can't allow the middle 70 to toil away in a form of obscurity, like a well-behaved, mild-mannered middle child in a family of attention-grabbing prodigies and troublemakers. Well-managed companies fight that bull. In fact, they make sure managers spend at least half of their people time on their biggest constituency, evaluating and coaching them. Further, they don't forget the middle 70 when it comes to rewards, recognition, and training. One important note, in larger companies, the middle 70 can be a highly differentiated group. In a way, it has its own top 20, valuable middle, and bottom 10%. You need to recognize those performance variations. You can be sure the employees do. In fact, a common and damaging dynamic is the departure of the best performers in the middle 70. Some of these individuals are almost stars. Their performance is that close. But when they get lumped with the middle 70 and are not managed attentively, they leave in frustration for a company where they will be more appreciated. That's a real loss. Future stars are often very hard at work, quietly in the middle 70. A good company recognizes that and makes it clear that this ranking is just a snapshot in time. It encourages this group using every tool in its people management kit. The point is, the middle 70 matters a lot. It is the heart and soul, the central core of any company. If you're going to manage people well, you simply cannot forget the majority of them. Practice 6, design the organization chart to be as flat as possible, with blindingly clear reporting relationships and responsibilities. In 2004, Clayton Dubilier and Rice purchased Culligan International, the water treatment and supply business, with about $700 million in annual sales and about 5,000 employees spread across 13 countries. One of CG&I's partners, George Tamke, the former co-CEO of Emerson Electric, was named chairman. George was well aware that Culligan had been through 10 owners in the previous 15 years, but he couldn't believe the organizational disarray that hit him when he walked through the door. George found that many employees simply didn't know where they fit in, whom they reported to, who reported to them, and what results each person was responsible for. George had had the luxury of starting the business for 90 days prior to CG&I's closing the deal, so he had a clear idea of how Culligan should be organized. Within 30 days, George and Culligan's relatively new CEO, Mike Kochmer, had designed and implemented a new org chart that eliminated any confusion. It's too early to talk about the impact of this change on Culligan's bottom line, but based on my all-too-frequent GE experience clearing up confusing and otherwise ambiguous structures, it will be significant. Culligan's situation, unfortunately, is not unique to old, established multinationals. Just recently, I spoke with Dara Khosrowshahi, the new CEO at the online travel company Expedia. Dara also walked into an org chart quagmire when he arrived on the job at the end of 2004. Expedia, less than 10 years old and highly entrepreneurial, had been growing so fast no one had taken the time to clarify reporting roles and responsibilities. As his first priority, Dara set out to fix that. My goal here is not to describe how to come up with the perfect org chart. Each company will do that differently based on its size and the business it's in. But some principles apply across the board. If you want to manage people effectively, help them by making sure the org chart leaves as little as possible to the imagination. It should paint a crystal clear picture of reporting relationships and make it patently obvious who is responsible for what results. Just as important, it should be flat. Look, every layer in an organization puts spin on a new initiative or organizational event. It's like that children's whispering game, telephone. Every time a piece of information travels through another person, it changes. Layers do that too, adding interpretation and buzz as information travels up and down the ladder. The trick then is to have fewer rungs. Layers have other vices. They add cost and complexity to everything. They slow things down because they increase the number of approvals and meetings required for anything to move forward. They have an odious way of burying new businesses or small units in big companies in honeycombs of bureaucracy. They tend to make little generals out of perfectly normal people who find themselves in hierarchies that respond only to rank. The awfulness of layers is nothing new to anyone, and yet companies gravitate toward them. For some, layers feel like the only way to respond to growth. More sales? Quick, add more district managers in the field. More employees? Quick, add more staff at headquarters. For others, the reasoning's even worse. Layers are a way to give people the feeling of growth when there is none. Layers allow you to give employees promotions instead of raises. That's better than doing nothing, right? Wrong. The inexorable pull towards layers is why I suggest you make your company 50% flatter than you'd normally feel comfortable with. Managers should have 10 direct reports at the minimum and 30 to 50% more if they're experienced. When you've got great players, you'll get the most out of them if their reporting relationship and responsibilities are blindingly clear. Your organization chart is not the only way to accomplish that, but it's a necessary first step. Now, after you've hired great people, your job becomes managing them into a winning team. To do that, make HR matter, with a cadre of pastor-parent types at the helm. Ensure people really know how they're doing, with evaluation systems that are honest and real. Motivate and retain wisely with money, recognition, and training. Face into charged relationships without flinching. Pay ample attention to your largest constituency, the middle 70%. And finally, get that organization chart flattened and straightened out. These six practices take time. That's true. But companies are not buildings, machines, or technologies. They are people. Besides managing them, what work matters more? Now for the hard part. For the previous three chapters of this book, I've talked about the exciting, energizing stuff of work. Leading, finding great players, and managing people into a winning team. But we all know that work is not a perpetual paradise. Work is more like the Garden of Eden. Sometimes people have to be let go. That event, be it a firing for non-performance, of a layoff for economic reasons, is awful, both for the person doing the casting out and obviously for the person being asked to leave. Most good managers find the actual deed incredibly difficult, feeling guilt and anxiety before, during, and after. As for the person being let go, it can be the worst day of his or her career. For some, work has been their identity, central routine, or second family, and being forced to leave is a kind of public death. For others, work may mean less emotionally, but it is a financial necessity, and the prospect of unemployment is frightening. This chapter is about how to manage a parting of ways with as little pain and damage as possible. Importantly, not all partings are created equal. First, there are the firings for integrity violations, stealing, lying, cheating, or any other form of ethical or legal breach. Then there are layoffs due to economic downturns. Finally, there are firings for non-performance. The last of these is the main focus of this chapter, because those are the ones that usually turn into bitter messes. It doesn't have to be that way. The antidote is actually very straightforward. Managers need to accept that letting people go is not something to be avoided, delegated to HR, or done quickly with eyes closed. Instead, it is a process that they must fully own, guided by two principles: no surprises and minimal humiliation. But before we look in more depth at how to achieve those goals, let's talk about the first two forms of separation. Integrity violations are no-brainers. In such cases, you don't need to hesitate for a moment before firing someone or fret about it either. Just do it and make sure the organization knows why, so that the consequences of breaking the rules are not lost on anyone. Layoffs due to the economy are more complicated. Think of all the times you've turned on the evening news to see angry employees protesting outside the gates of a plant or the front door of an office building. Layoffs have just been announced, and people are in shock. They feel as though a bomb has dropped on them out of nowhere. You can bet the top team doesn't feel that way. They probably knew layoffs were in the offing for months. The fact that everyone else didn't is really unconscionable. Every employee, not just the senior people, should know how a company is doing. Of course, financial information is not always that easy to get your hands on. If you are running a 10-person division of a conglomerate, for instance, you may only have access to data about your business, but know little about how other businesses are performing. On the other hand, if you are running a 10-person machine shop, there is no reason in the world why employees should know about every vital sign of the business: the volume of orders, the size and trend line of profit margins, emerging low-cost competitors, and so forth. For most managers, the availability of financial data lies somewhere between these extremes. Your job is to get as much as you can and get it to your people as clearly and frequently as possible. That way, if layoffs must occur, at least people will have some level of preparation. The same principle holds for layoffs due to market changes. During the internet boom, for example, lots of companies scrambled frantically to hire technical gurus by the truckload. As the reality of e-commerce settled in, it quickly became obvious to many of these organizations that their hiring had been excessive, and some of the techies would have to go. Again, open communication should be the order of the day. Last year at a Q&A session in Orlando, Florida, I was introduced to the audience by the owner and CEO of a New England-based consulting and training firm. Before the session, I asked her about her business. She told me it had taken a real hit after the internet bubble burst. She'd had to lay off half of her 30 employees. How'd it go, I asked. Incredibly well, she answered to my surprise. My husband and I practiced open book management. Our employees knew everything about the state of the business. When the time came for the layoffs, people were sad, but they understood. Today, the business is flourishing, and many of the CEO's former employees have returned without bitterness. Needless to say, this is an ideal situation. The firm was small, and media coverage of the internet industry collapse helped make its economic troubles blindingly clear to employees. But even if your company is large and economic conditions are more vague, it always helps to have your cards on the table for employees to see in the event of a downturn. Now for the most complex and delicate kind of firing, when an individual has to be let go because of poor performance. Earlier, I used straightforward to describe the no-surprise, minimal humiliation approach to these situations. I didn't mean to make it sound easy. It is not. Unfortunately, you learn how to fire on the job, under the most stressful of circumstances. Nothing really prepares you. Managers don't sit around talking about how to do it, comparing notes. I'm not aware of any business schools that actually teach the process. And while company training programs might talk a lot about evaluations, none that I know of offer a lot of help on actually how to let people go. Which leaves you to your instincts. Maybe some people are born to fire well. I know I wasn't. I did it for years and never got used to it. I was particularly bad at it in my early years as a manager. One of my most painful memories from Pittsfield, where I ran plastics, is of the day that a boy got on the school bus and punched my son John in the face. I had fired the boy's dad the day before, and obviously I had done it wrong. It didn't make any difference that I thought I had handled the matter well. The boy's family didn't perceive it that way. Sometimes people screw up so royally they deserve to be fired without much ado. I once had a manager in plastics who had to be let go after 90 days because while he had a resume loaded with prestigious degrees and was as charming as could be in chit-chat, he was completely ineffective at every single task. A friend of mine was fired from her job as a clothing store clerk in the first week because she forgot to ask half the customers to sign their credit card slips. She says that if her boss hadn't fired her, she would have fired herself. Usually, however, firings for non-performance aren't so black and white. There's lots more gray about who did what and what went wrong to lead up to the finale. Because of that, there are three main ways that managers get firing wrong: moving too fast, not using enough candor, and taking too long. For an example of the first dynamic, take the case of a friend of mine who ran a 60-person unit within a 300-employee company. The company had been growing, and things were generally going well. It was privately held and had a family-like culture, meaning mediocre performance was generally tolerated in the name of congeniality. It was not uncommon for employees to carpool on weekdays and socialize on weekends. As with many small companies, performance reviews were generally informal events with lots of generic pleasantries. When my friend was promoted to head the unit, she soon realized that one of her chief lieutenants, the man in charge of distribution, whom I'll call Richard, was not up to the demands of the growing business. To exacerbate matters, Richard was a true disruptor, as described in the last chapter. He never missed an opportunity to challenge the authority of the new boss or her boss. Usually his negative comments came in the form of sarcastic humor with peers in the hallway. Richard's performance wasn't terrible, but it was pretty close. He regularly missed deadlines and seemed unable to handle increasingly complex logistics. My friend spoke to Richard several times about his shortcomings, to no avail. Finally, after a particularly tough period of Richard's corridor sniping, an important customer called to complain that his shipment was a week late. My friend had had it. Richard had to go. The official dismissal meeting could not have gone worse. To say Richard was surprised is an understatement. He blew up in anger, shouting, "You've got to be crazy. We don't fire people at this company, and you're going to pay for this." He then stormed out, ran back to his office in another part of the building, and called an impromptu meeting with his own 8-person staff. Even though he cleaned out his desk and was gone within hours, a hate management movement had been launched. Some of the unit's employees, in particular Richard's circle of friends, felt that he'd been fired without enough warning, and they complained they no longer trusted the boss or the organization. In the fraught weeks that followed, productivity dropped by an order of magnitude, as people spent inordinate amounts of time gathering behind closed doors to talk about Richard's departure, how it was handled, and who might be next. It took my friend about 3 months to restore equilibrium and get her unit moving again. The second firing mistake is a variation of Richard's case, and it involves lack of candor and a misunderstanding about fairness. Say you've got an employee named Gail. She can't reach her sales quotas, and her coworkers can't really count on her for one reason or another. She's damaging the unit's performance and morale. But Gail's friendly to everyone. She tries hard, and she's been with the company for years. Every time you attempt to tell her how badly she's doing, she's so cheerful and oblivious that the conversation gets muddled, and you end up hiding your negative feelings behind a forced smile and a mixed message about working smarter. Then the situation reaches a crisis stage. Gail really screws up, and in a burst of impulsive anger, you fire her. She's shocked and starts to remind you of all the positive feedback you've given her over the years. You respond by coming up with a severance package that feels pretty rich to you, given how much she's underperformed. She hates the package. It's insulting, she says, and she gets angry. You get angry back, because you can't believe she's angry. You feel she should be grateful you carried it for so long. The next thing you know, Gail's gone from shocked to angry to bitter as she walks out the door. This may not be the last you hear of her. Think about the last time you lost a promising hire or a potential customer. They might have been talking to Gail, who went out to become an ambassador for your company. Lucky you. Every employee who leaves is a spokesperson for the company. For the next 5, 10, or 20 years, they can badmouth or praise. In the most extreme cases, people fired take their anger public, and a few become so-called whistleblowers. I say so-called because I've seen too many companies exposed wrongly by people seeking nothing more than revenge for a firing conducted by a manager who should have and could have done it better. And now for the third mistake. It occurs when a firing happens too slowly, and you get a kind of dead man walking effect. Everyone knows a person is about to be fired, including the person himself. But the boss waits a long time to pull the trigger. The result is enormous awkwardness in the office that can lead to a form of paralysis. I've seen the dead man walking effect more times than I care to remember. I can recall a staff meeting at headquarters when I was a division VP. About 10 people were there, including one of my peers, we'll call Steve, who had been having consistently bad results. Before the meeting even started, everyone already sensed that Steve was a goner. But once the meeting began, the discomfort got worse. The group's boss picked apart Steve's quarterly results and wouldn't allow Steve to open his mouth for a rebuttal. Steve could do nothing right. At the coffee break, everyone milled around, avoiding Steve as much as possible. None of us could look him in the eye. Unfortunately, it took about a year before Steve was let go. At every staff meeting, we watched in agony as the self-confidence seeped out of him. You just knew the people in Steve's businesses had to be crippled, as they were undoubtedly seeing the same thing and were only waiting to find out who his replacement would be. The question, of course, is, why do bosses allow the dead man walking effect to occur? One reason is that firing is so tough that no one likes to do it, and so the event often gets delayed. But with a dead man situation, something more subtle is often going on. Bosses let an employee twist in the wind because they want the victim's peers to see and, figuratively speaking, sign off on the necessity of the firing decision. In a way, it's cruel, but most bosses would rather be known as careful than quick-triggered. Richard, Gail, and Steve are examples of how firing goes wrong. How do you get it right? First, no surprises. You can take the surprise out of economic downturn layoffs with lots of financial information. But how do you take the surprise out of gray area, non-performance firings? We've actually already dealt with that question in the chapters preceding this one, in those discussing candor, differentiation, and good people management processes. In particular, the answer lies in using a rigorous evaluation system with its regular formal and informal reviews. Very simply, a good performance evaluation process informs and prepares people in the fairest, most open way I know. If people know where they stand, in fact, a firing actually never happens. Instead, when things are not working out, eventually there's a mutual understanding that it's time to part ways. In this kind of environment, where the employee is doing okay, but not quite what you want, it can take a couple of years for the end game to be clear to everyone. Over that time period, there'll be many candid conversations about performance and career goals. The possibility of parting ways will have been raised and discussed openly. In the ideal situation, the last conversation will go like this. The boss says, "Well, I think you know what this meeting's about." The employee answers, "Yes, I guess I do. So what are your thoughts on timing and what's the deal?" Moreover, as a result of this process, sometimes you get lucky and the employee will come to you first. The employee will say, "I've got a great job offer and I think I'm going to go for it. What do you think?" The boss answers, "What a great career move for you. I think you should take it." These kinds of partings are rarely acrimonious, and surprise is the last thing anyone feels. Cases like Richard, Gail, and Steve can never be eliminated entirely, but with candid and consistent evaluation processes in place, they can become less and less common every year. Now, you want to minimize humiliation in any firing. To take the sting and embarrassment out of it, you first have to understand the emotional timeline of the experience. For the boss, the timeline begins long before the actual event. In preparing for it, you feel nervous, frustrated, and anguished. Unless you're a complete jerk, you dread the whole thing, especially the conversation itself. For weeks, you lose sleep, rehearsing how it'll go. You talk to your spouse, a best friend about the situation, to help get your nerve up. Meanwhile, your employee is scared, but from my experience, usually optimistic until the end. Denial is the operative emotion. Most people walk into termination meetings hoping against hope this isn't the day, a feeling usually mixed with gut-wrenching fear. So the day finally comes and you sit down. You deliver the bad news and suddenly you feel relieved. The anxiety flows out of you. It's over, you think. I did it kindly. I said nice things. The package is fair. Phew. At last I can get on to other work, including hiring someone great to fill the soon-to-be vacant spot. You go home feeling that a terrible weight is off your shoulders. Dinner that night tastes better than it has in a while. Your employee is in another emotional time zone, to put it mildly. Even if he has been well prepared by candid evaluations, he is crushed. His self-esteem is in the tank. If you have done everything right, he won't be surprised, but he could still be feeling terribly sad and hurt. The next day at work is when you must start to act against your instincts. Yes, the employee's done a poor job, and yes, he's taken up a disproportionate amount of your time and energy already. But until he departs, your job is to make sure he doesn't feel as if he's in a leper colony. Build up his self-confidence. Coach him. Let him know there's a good job out there for him, where his skills are a much better match. You may even help him find that job. Your goal for the fired employee is a soft landing wherever he goes. A firing may take an hour, but someone's departure can take 6 months. You'll save a lot of pain and preserve a lot of pride if you don't rush it. The unfortunate reality is firings are a part of business, but that doesn't mean they have to end up as the bitter messes they often do. If you handle them right, they'll never be enjoyable, but they can be tolerable for all involved. The legacy of a firing lasts a long time. For you, your company, and most of all for the person who has been fired. Obviously, if your company's collapsing, you can't handle layoffs with kid gloves. And if someone has an integrity violation, you need to kick that person out the door and fast. But for everyone else, leaving for reasons more in the gray area, remember that every time there is a parting of ways, you own the process. When it's time to let someone go, do it right. No surprises, no humiliation. The next chapter in the Your Company section of the book is all about change. It's entitled Mountains Do Move. I'm sure you've noticed the hand-wringing and hyperventilating about change out there. For more than a decade, there's been a whole industry devoted to the topic, all of it selling pretty much the same line, change or die. Well, it's true. Change is an absolutely critical part of business. You do need to change, preferably before you have to. What you've heard about resistance to change is also true. People hate it when their bosses announce a transformation initiative. They run back to their cubicles and frantically start emailing one another with reasons it's going to ruin everything. Frankly, most people hate it when they find out their favorite coffee shop is closing. The Times of London changed to a tabloid format, and the editor told me he received a letter asking him how it felt to be the person responsible for ending Western civilization. People love familiarity and patterns. They cling to them. The phenomenon is so entrenched, it can only be chalked up to human nature. But attributing a behavior to human nature doesn't mean you have to be controlled by it. Yes, managing change can sometimes feel like moving a mountain. But managing change can also be incredibly exciting and rewarding, particularly when you start seeing results. During my years at GE, we were in a pretty constant state of change. Most companies today are. You have to be if you want to stay in the game, let alone win. That said, I realize that change is not a layup. Over the past couple of years, I've been struck by the number of people at Q&A sessions who have asked me, "My organization needs to change. How can I get them to do it when everyone wants things to stay the same?" The question is usually delivered with a level of despair. My first answer is always a question back. "Are you really the only person who sees a need for change?" I ask. If you are, and you don't have some form of authority, make your case. And if you don't get anywhere with it, learn to live with it or get out. Why stay where you're frustrated? But if the situation is not that extreme, and it usually isn't, that is, you have the power to get things done, and a few supporters as well, then you can make something happen.